Welcome to this Tuesday, snowy Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to talk about health insurance. It sure can feel complicated and now more expensive for many North Dakotans. We'll learn about healthcare tax credits, whether they're still available, and can they reduce monthly premiums and out-of-pocket costs. David Benson will walk us through what North Dakotans should know. And that's coming up in just a bit.
Well, maybe, just maybe, if Teddy Roosevelt were alive today, the equivalents of the anti-couch potato manifesto from his strenuous life essays would be something like Nike's Just Do It, or maybe the old standby no pain, no gain. For one father-son adventure in the former president's favorite place, the Badlands of North Dakota, and his namesake park, the lesson was less about trying to toughen up a child in the face of potential bullying and more about being true to one's nature. Sam Graham Felsen is a former political blogger and writer. His debut novel, Green, picked up the American Library Association's Alex Award, and his nonfiction writings have appeared in the Washington Post and the New York Times, among others. His most recent New York Times Magazine article is called, I Tried to Toughen Up My Son, Things Didn't Go as Planned. Sam, glad you can join us on Prairie Public today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, we often get folks stopping by the Fargo Visitor Center on the eastern side of the state to take a selfie in front of the famous wood chipper from the Fargo movie. And then they could tell all their friends on Facebook that they'd been to all 50 states. And Theodore Roosevelt National Park is often last on the National Park bucket list. First of all, when you arrived with your son Saul, after getting through some initial challenges, we'll talk about that in a minute, but what were your first impressions of the park itself?
I have to say it's my favorite national park that I have ever been to. It's beautiful. I think it's wildly underrated. The Badlands in South Dakota has way more visitors. And frankly, I think Teddy Roosevelt National Park is more beautiful. And one of the nice things about it is that there aren't as many visitors. So you get a lot of the park to yourself. My son and I went hiking for hours without seeing anyone. So it almost felt like we had a giant playground all to ourselves. So I couldn't recommend it more. I mean, I know I'm talking on a North Dakota public radio show, so some of you have actually been there. But for those who haven't been there, I sort of describe it as an upside down cake version of the Grand Canyon. It's got these beautiful striated multi-layered rocks of different colors, and it's just an amazing place to get lost and kind of find yourself along the way.
So, you know, I would ask, why did you, but more importantly, why did your son Saul want to follow in the footsteps of President Theodore Roosevelt?
So my son is an unusual kid. He's not into sports. What he's into is national parks. Together in the past year, we've gone to 30 different national park sites. And I should just clarify, those are not national parks like Yosemite, you know, necessarily. A lot of the national parks we've been to are national historic sites. And North Dakota and South Dakota have some amazing national historic sites and national monuments, not just, you know, their iconic national parks. So we've been to a lot of these places together. And I told him that this past summer, he could pick one park to go to, and we'd spend a week traveling there. And I said, basically, you could pick anywhere in the United States, at least in the continental United States. I'm not sure I was ready to go to Alaska, but he said, I want to go to North Dakota because I want to go to Teddy Roosevelt National Park. And the reason why is because as he got obsessed with national parks, he did his research and he discovered that Teddy Roosevelt is, you know, kind of like the godfather of the national parks. He didn't start the first national park. And he wasn't the guy who had the idea for national parks. That was John Muir. And the first national park, I believe, was Ulysses S. Grant. But Theodore Roosevelt did more than any other president to expand the national parks and to expand public lands in general. And today, about a third of the whole country is actually publicly owned land. And that's totally to the credit of Theodore Roosevelt. I discovered through my son's interest that Theodore Roosevelt wasn't only the greatest conservationist in American history, I would argue he's the greatest conservationist in human history. I mean, he did more to set aside land to be preserved and not be developed by developers, exploited by, you know, miners and loggers. And he's really the guy who put the idea of getting out in nature, finding yourself away from the comforts of technology and modern conveniences. So my son was inspired by Roosevelt, and that's why we ended up coming to North Dakota, because we wanted to follow in his footsteps.
Well, and speaking of following in footsteps, we're getting a sense of what Saul is like as a young man, and you can't help but love this kid, you know. But how far did the apple fall from the tree? What about you as a kid? Were you like Saul? Was Saul like you?
Like Saul, I was not particularly athletic. I was tall and skinny, just like he is. I was not a very tough kid. I was a little different from him in that I really cared about being cool and accepted. So I tried to, you know, play sports, but I was not a natural athlete. I was not a tough kid. And I was the kind of kid who actually ran away from fights, lived in a lot of fear. I was mugged as a kid. That had a big sort of profound impact on my self-confidence. So as an adult, I discovered fitness and lifting weights, and I've even taken martial arts classes, and I have a lot more self-confidence now. And I sort of looked at my son. I saw that, you know, some kids were starting to pick on him a little bit because he's a different kind of kid. And I thought to myself, like, I don't want him to get bullied. I don't want him to get, you know, pushed around the way I did, because it hurt my self-confidence. I want him to continue to be a self-confident kid and feel good about himself. So I kind of had the idea, I wanted to try to get him to the place where I'm at now, where I feel more physically confident, more confident in general. But I wanted to get him there a little bit quicker than I got there, because it took me until probably my mid-30s to get to the place where I felt like that. You know, I hoped maybe I can accelerate things and get him there a little bit quicker. And so I had this kind of cockamamie idea that, you know, maybe if I took him to this park and we did some strenuous life activities together and kind of, you know, learned more about Teddy Roosevelt together, that he might be inspired not just by the fact that Teddy Roosevelt founded these parks, but by the fact that Teddy Roosevelt, in fact, was a kid very much like him and very much like me, a nerdy, I mean, by his own account, a weakling, who got bullied, who got beat up by other kids, but somebody who transformed himself into this kind of iconic masculine figure who, you know, to this day is seen as kind of like the emblem of what it means to be a quote unquote real man. So I had this kind of idea, you know, it was half tongue in cheek, but half serious, that I hoped we could not just follow in the footsteps of Teddy Roosevelt, but actually kind of emulate his journey from weakling to tough guy. That was the idea, at least. Quite go as planned.
You are listening to Main Street on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Etheridge. We're talking to Sam Graham Felsen about his latest article for the New York Times Magazine, "I Tried to Toughen Up My Son, Things Didn't Go as Planned," all about his father-son journey to Theodore Roosevelt National Park last summer. Give us a little TR refresher. What was it that brought Teddy out to the Badlands?
First of all, he was beat up as a kid. He had one particular incident where two kids kind of jumped him, and he felt terrible about himself after that. So he started sort of engaging in these strenuous physical activities to make himself stronger, because he said he never wanted to be victimized like that again. So he was already on a path of self-improvement and physical improvement, and he kind of wanted to get ready for the worst that could come at him. Like, he never wanted to feel like a victim again. But of course, he was not prepared for what happened to him. What happened to Teddy Roosevelt, for those who are unfamiliar, is, I mean, it's unimaginable. It's probably one of the worst things that could possibly befall a human being. Teddy Roosevelt, when he's 22 years old, he's happily married. He's got a great career as a politician in the New York State Assembly. His future just looks incredibly bright. And his wife is delivering their first child. So he gets a telegram that morning in Albany. It's a girl. You're having a baby. Congratulations on being a father for the first time. And it's basically the greatest moment of his life. Then a few hours later, he gets another telegram. And it says, "Bad news. Your wife actually died as a result of the childbirth, and you need to rush home immediately." And not only that, but your mom died too on the exact same day.
Oh my goodness.
This was Valentine's Day, which just adds, you know, further insult to injury of like the cruelness of fate. So he rushes home. His mother has already passed away, but he's at his wife's side, sort of helplessly holding her hand, crying next to her as she dies, and there's nothing he can do for her. And it's just this crushing, crushing blow. And his life is never the same. He decides he's going to leave the New York State Assembly, you know, and he gets on a train and he heads to Medora. And he had been to North Dakota. He had been to North Dakota a couple years earlier to go on a buffalo hunt. And he fell in love with the place and he came back because he decided that he was going to sort of set aside his political career and try to make it as a rancher. But really what he was doing was he was trying to find himself. He was trying to find direction. I mean, the bottom had truly fell out in his life and he was trying to pick up the pieces and figure out where do I go from here? And what he found was that being in this unforgiving land, you know, with these brutally cold winters and these you know, scorching summers and these, you know, this landscape that was an unforgiving, harsh landscape, by working the land, by driving cattle, by working, you know, long days, sometimes 14, 18-hour days, and kind of out-hustling all the other cowboys who kind of at first looked at him askance and were like, who is this northern guy with the funny accent who uses all these posh words? But he proved himself. He proved that he was tough. He proved that he could work just as hard, if not harder, than everyone else. And he gained their respect. And he fell in love with the state. He fell in love with the land. And he fell in love with the idea of hard work. And he credits his time in Medora as what gave him the character that allowed him to become president of the United States. And by the way, he wasn't just a good president. He was one of our greatest presidents. He is routinely ranked in the top four presidents in American history. And he credits North Dakota for giving him that foundation, that character.
Yeah, and hence the reason why next summer, July 4th, they are going to be dedicated in the Theodore Roosevelt Library in Medora.
That's right. And we actually, it was really nice. I heard from, after I published this article in the Times, I heard from the president of that library who told me he loved the article and invited me and my son to come out there for the opening. So we're going to come back to Medora this summer, and we can't wait to.
You answered my next question. That's exactly what I was going to ask you. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, Sam, I have to tell you on a personal aside. A few years ago, I got together with an old classmate of mine. Now, his son was part of a Cub Scout troop that came through the building at the radio station where I worked at. I hosted the tour. So we went out to lunch, and he told me that he did everything he could to discourage his boy from joining the Scouts because of another old classmate of ours who got mercilessly bullied about it in elementary school and middle school. And he was like, I do not want that for my son. But his son insisted. His friends were in it, and so, of course, he joined. So your article hit me in that kind of way, that the kids of yesterday, well, are they as cruel as they were when we were growing up? I mean, there's so much awareness about bullying. Do you think that the worries about Saul being bullied maybe have been a bit dated? Was that projection on your part?
I think it was projection, and I think those worries were a bit dated. And having said that, look, cyberbullying is a huge problem. I think a lot of the bullying has just gone online.
Right.
But the kind of stuff that was happening when I was a kid, I'm 44 years old now, mm-hmm. you know, kids getting called, especially boys getting called sissy, getting called worse than that.
Yeah.
That kind of thing, I think, has really diminished, at least where I live. I don't know if that's true of the rest of the country, but kids, I think, are a little bit more accepting of difference now. I think there's a lot more awareness of kids being of different cultures, different backgrounds, kids having different interests. You know, there's anti-bullying training in my son's school. There's autism awareness. So there is a lot more tolerance. And by the way, you know, my son is in Cub Scouts. That's part of how he got into nature and got into national parks. And Cub Scouts is actually like a, you know, it's not like a dorky loser thing at my son's school. There are a lot of like really nice, cool kids in the Cub Scouts.
Yeah.
I do think times have changed to a degree, but look, I still think it's hard to be a boy, you know? Yeah. And I don't want to take away from how hard it is to be a girl. I have a daughter as well. And, you know, she faces her own challenges and in this world, but I think boys feel a lot of pressure to be, you know, masculine in a specific defined way that has a lot to do with sports, that has a lot to do with physical, you know, brawn. And, you know, boys who exhibit, you know, more softness and gentleness, I do think even in today's more accepting climate are at a little bit of a risk of becoming targets. And that was my concern. Like, and I probably was overdoing it because I was basing, you know, basing a lot of my fears on my own upbringing. But I just felt like what I wanted for my son, I didn't need him to be some MMA cage fighter, but what I wanted him to be, I just wanted him to be resilient. You know, I wanted him to be the kind of kid who, if someone was picking on him, he would have the courage to stand up and say, hey, get away from me, you know, leave me alone.
Right.
Like, get a life, basically. Like, and I could, cause I was not that kind of kid. When someone picked on me when I was a kid, I just kind of crouched and cowered and, you know, waited for it to end.
Retreated. Yes. Definitely the flight of the fight and flight response.
Exactly. I used to say I was all flight, no fight.
Yeah. Same. I experienced the same thing in my childhood too. So Sam, tell me about your adventures with Saul in Theodore Roosevelt National Park. So now you're there. What did you see and what did you experience with Saul? Did you sort of witness any metamorphoses?
So it was interesting. Early on, I should just say up front, we didn't do cattle ranching or any truly hardcore, you know, macho activities. We did what you do in national parks. We went on hikes, basically. You know, we explored the parks. And at first, he was doing the same kind of thing I did it as a kid, which is complaining about every 5 seconds. I'm tired. I want a snack. I want to go back to the visitor center. You know, can I please have your phone so I can play some game on your phone? You know, he was complaining a lot. Yeah. And I think I was maybe overdoing a little bit. Like, you know, one of our first hikes was like 3 miles, and for him, that's a long hike. So I was getting a little discouraged thinking like, you know, how fun is this going to be? Like, if he's going to complain the whole time on these hikes, like, should I even bother to keep pushing him to do hikes? Because it's not going to be fun for him or me if this continues. So we spent a couple days in the South Unit of Theodore Roosevelt National Park, which is the more popular unit of the park. Then we drove an hour north to the North Unit a couple days later. North Unit is much less populated and more rugged, I would say. Mm-hmm. I think North Unit is spectacular. I highly recommend it for people who haven't been. I liked it even better than the South Unit, and there were far, far fewer people there. And in the North Unit, the ranger said to us, you know, you're really allowed out here to go wherever you want. You don't even have to stay on the trail. So Saul got excited about that idea, and he said, "Hey, Dad, pull over there. That rock formation looks cool." So we pulled over. We started climbing up this butte. It was attached to another taller butte, which was attached to another taller butte, and Saul just kept climbing and kept climbing, and I started to get a little bit nervous because we were getting really far from our car, but he was showing so much bravery and so much enthusiasm about the hike that I just decided to let him keep going. And in fact, at one point he turns back to me and he says, "Come on, Dad, like, what are you, chicken? Like, you're afraid to keep going, you know, come on, we're living the strenuous life." You know, he's saying all the things to me that I had been saying to him the previous days. And we actually got so high at one point, we were on this sort of narrow ridgeline on one of the buttes, and the sky started to change colors a little bit. It started to get windy, and I started to think, uh-oh, this does not look good. We better get down. And he was really insisting on, you know, he wanted to keep going. I had to say, we really have to turn around. We could get blown off of this butte, and there are, you know, we're so far from the trail, I don't even know if the rangers would be able to find us. So that convinced him. We walked back down the trail, and at one point I actually slipped and slid, you know, probably, I don't know, 15 feet or so. And he was actually ahead of me on the slope on the way down. And I actually slid right into him pretty hard. And I was worried that he was going to freak out. And I looked down, my leg was all bloody. And he's also afraid of the sight of blood. He hates getting shot. So I'm like, oh, great. This is, you know, I wasn't hurt too bad, but I was thinking, oh, great. This is going to, you know, freak him out. We've got another mile or two to walk back to our car. But he looked at me and says, "You're going to be okay, Dad. It's just a little cut. You'll be all right. You know, get back up. You got this." So I looked, I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, wow, like, did my crazy plan to like toughen up my son in 1 week and turn him into a junior Teddy Roosevelt, is it really working? Like, is he already transforming this quickly? And, you know, I started getting a little bit, you know, overexcited because, of course, kids don't work like that. Kids never change overnight. And in fact, if they do change overnight, often what happens is that they change in another direction the very next night, which, right, of course, is what happened on the trip.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Detheridge. We're talking with Sam Graham Felsen about his latest article for the New York Times Magazine, "I Tried to Toughen Up My Son. Things didn't go as planned." It sounds like you said, that you set out to accomplish something and you did, but and I won't spoil the ending of the article because it's great, but did it work?
Yeah, I won't give away the ending of the article either, because it is a fun little surprise ending for those who are interested in reading it. But I will say that one thing that happened on the trip In fact, the afternoon after we had had that great experience in the North Unit, we had a long drive because we decided to drive to South Dakota to go check out Rushmore and the parks down there. So we had like a 6 or 7 hour drive. And I'm sort of giving him a prize for being such a good trooper all day. So I let him have my iPad to watch some movies. And I try to limit it because, you know, my son, like probably everyone's son in America, is addicted to screens. And, you know, I try to limit it as much as I can. And he had been watching like Home Alone 2 for the 1,000th time. And I said, you know, why don't you watch a different movie? Look, Pee-wee's Big Adventure is streaming now. That was one of my favorite movies as a kid. Why don't you check that out? You know, it's kind of like a goofier, weirder version of Mr. Rogers. And I said, trust me, you're going to like this movie. So he keeps watching. And like minutes later, I start hearing just howling laughter from the backseat. And, you know, basically my son falls in love with Pee-wee Herman. And Pee-wee is the exact opposite of Teddy. He is the kind of guy who runs away from fights. Or if he doesn't run away, he relies on his wits and he relies on tricks and gags to defeat the bigger enemy. And my son just kind of fell in love with this character. And, you know, for the rest of the trip, he's basically rewatched that movie 6 or 7 times. And it's interesting. It's not that he stopped liking Teddy Roosevelt, although he did start to question some of the more problematic aspects of Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, like how he treated his family, right?
Sure. The fact that he left, you know, when he went to Medora for those 2 years, he essentially left his daughter behind, the daughter who had just been born. He left his daughter with his sister, and he was a guy who, you know, very much embraced violence. You know, some people might say at this point that he was an imperialist because the Spanish-American War, which he played a role in, was, basically an imperialistic war. And so my son is starting to, you know, as we're learning more and more about Teddy Roosevelt together on this trip, he's starting to see that Teddy Roosevelt isn't exactly all perfection and that there are some sides that he's not into. And meanwhile, he's also finding this other model of what it means to be a man that's pretty much the exact opposite of Teddy Roosevelt. And I think he came away from the trip feeling that he still admired Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, he still has a poster of Teddy Roosevelt in his bedroom, and he still admires him. But I think he started to admire other models of what it means to be a man as well.
Pee-wee Herman projects a lot of confidence too. He was always confident in every setting. He didn't back down from anything like that, and he used humor to sort of soften up the bullies, if you will. So I think that's a pretty good model actually to emulate. So I was struck by another one of your recent articles titled "Where Have All My Deep Male Friendships Gone?" I'm living that in my moment now at age 57. That also appeared in the New York Times Magazine in May of this year. The title itself is a question. What was the answer to that question?
So the answer was that they hadn't really gone anywhere. I was the one who went somewhere. I went inside and stayed inside. And I was the one who had stopped making an effort to reach out to my friends. And, you know, I know I'm not alone here because I got hundreds and hundreds of emails from men all across the country from all different walks of life who had said, hey, I experienced the same thing where, you know, I kind of woke up one day in my 40s and I'm like, whoa, weird. I feel lonely. You know, what's that all about? And for me, it was especially shocking because I was a guy who had a million friends as a kid. You know, I was a pretty popular kid. I had a lot of, you know, not just friends, but really, really close friends. And basically, as I got older, you know, first I started getting more career focused. I got married. I had kids. And at each step along the way, I was spending less and less time socializing with my friends and more time by myself. And after a while, it's almost like a muscle. It's like, if you don't activate your socializing muscle, it atrophies. And I realized that I had a problem. And when I started to do some research, I realized that I was far from alone. I mean, the statistics are really pretty shocking. Men nowadays are, you know, struggling across the board with friendship. In like the 90s, men had like 5 times more men had close friendships, 6 or more close friendships than they have today. And many, many men report having 0 friendships at all. And that was kind of the genesis of the article. But I also explored sort of like, you know, ways to get out of this funk and start socializing more. And I will say, you know, I'm not just saying this to have a feel good message here. I have over the past year, like totally turned things around. Like I'm spending way more time hanging out with my male friends. Just this past week, I hung out with three different male friends on three different nights of the week. So, wow. So I have changed, and I've seen that if you make an effort, it's pretty easy to get that muscle back.
As you pointed out, like way back in the day, a couple of centuries ago, you know, it was normal for men to hold hands, to write each other pretty intimate letters, but in a non-sexual kind of way. And we've come just the opposite from that. That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, look, Teddy Roosevelt wrote about his male friendships in North Dakota, you know, how much he loved hanging out with these other guys and, you know, working the land with these guys and hanging out by the campfire and telling funny stories. And Abraham Lincoln, I quoted Abraham Lincoln in my essay. Abraham Lincoln had a best friend who he was so close with, he would write him these letters that today, if we read them, they would sound like love letters. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of it has to do with men fearing that if they show any kind of softness or desire for, you know, greater intimacy with their male friends, that they might be seen as not quite manly and, you know, losing masculine face. And so a lot of men just kind of retreat inwards and act tough around each other and, you know, basically express two kinds of emotional registers, which is anger and joking around. You know, those are the two ones that I think men are most comfortable in.
Sam Graham Felsen's latest article for the New York Times Magazine is titled, "I Tried to Toughen Up My Son, Things Didn't Go as Planned." You can find his nonfiction work and get info about his award-winning coming-of-age novel, Green, at his website at samgf.com. Sam, it's been a pleasure getting to know you and your son, who, is a total adventurer, total dude, you know? Thanks for sharing your stories with us on Main Street today.
Thank you. Well, maybe I'll see you on July 4th in Medora.
Still to come on Main Street, the latest about healthcare subsidies, what every North Dakotan should know. That's after this. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today we're taking on one of the most confusing but most important parts of keeping healthcare affordable for North Dakotans, and that's healthcare tax credits. These credits can dramatically lower insurance premiums and out-of-pocket costs, yet many people still aren't sure what they are, who qualifies, or how they actually work. We'll walk through the basics, premium tax credits, advanced credits, and cost-sharing reductions, and look at how income, household size, rural costs, and North Dakota's unique workforce all factor into eligibility. We'll also break down how to apply through healthcare.gov, how to avoid surprises at tax time, and how North Dakotans commonly misunderstand what they misunderstand about these benefits. Joining me today is David Benson. He's the Senior Campaigns Manager for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, and he'll help us understand how these credits shape healthcare access across the state and what the future may hold for affordability in North Dakota. Certainly a topic that is on many of our listeners' minds. David, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
What are healthcare tax credits? Please give us an introduction.
Well, we got to go back to the time when Congress passed the Affordable Care Act in 2010. It provided what is called advanced premium tax credits for low and moderate income people to help them afford their premiums. These are permanents, and these are the tax credits are not set to expire. But later in 2021, as part of the Rescue Plan Act, and later extended by Congress, they increased the generosity of those tax credits by increasing the amount of the tax credit and increasing the number of people who qualify. Those tax credits are referred to as enhanced premium tax credits, EPTCs. Some folks call them healthcare tax credits. And so as individuals in North Dakota and across the country are looking to access health insurance coverage through the marketplace, they are looking to possibly be eligible for either of those tax credits. And as I mentioned before, those EPTCs, those enhanced premium tax credits, are set to expire at the end of the year. And with doing so, it's going to increase the cost for thousands of North Dakotans. We're looking at those tax credits are at risk of expiring for more than 35,000 North Dakotans. And as the insurance commissioner stated, I believe back in September, he's expecting sharp increase of premiums to expecting those thousands of individuals. And because of that, you're going to be looking at over as many as 10,000 North Dakotans who may choose to go uninsured or looking at other types of options that are definitely not viable. They're not comprehensive coverage and can create chaos, affordability challenges for those individuals. And we might dive into this a little bit more, Craig, but I think when we're looking at these tax credits, it's not just individuals that are benefiting from these tax credits. We're already looking at premium increases for everyone because of the chaos and uncertainty that is existing with the lack of action by Congress to extend the tax credits.
I'm blessed. I have group health insurance through Prairie Public. I'm very grateful for that. But many North Dakotans do not. Aren't there deadlines coming up for when you need to make decisions about what you would like to do in the marketplace?
Yeah, so for those on the marketplace, there's a specific open enrollment that is happening right now, and that goes until January 15th. But there's also the deadline that Congress needs to act by December 15th to ensure that individuals that sign up for coverage have coverage in place starting January 1st. And so that's why you're hearing a lot of activity and conversations that are happening in Washington right now, because they're not only looking at the end of the year, but December 15th to ensure that folks have that continuity of coverage, which is so important for cancer patients and survivors. And that's one of the concerns that we have as an organization advocating for cancer patients and survivors. Having access to affordable, comprehensive health insurance coverage is a key determinant for surviving cancer. And so you're running into a situation, if you're a cancer patient and you're benefiting from these tax credits and you're on the marketplace plan and might be at a place where you're just not sure what's going to happen for next year with these tax credits. You're seeing your window shopping and you're looking at what the costs are going to be for your plan, and you're seeing hundreds, possibly thousands of dollars of increase. There's been an estimate by KFF that North Dakotans will pay an average of $485 more dollars per month if these tax credits are not renewed. And so if you're living with that uncertainty in terms of affordability, what that coverage is going to look like, you may not sign up for a plan. Or if you're waiting to kind of see what plays out and they don't act by December 15th, you might be in limbo even signing up for a plan, say on December 31st, where that plan doesn't kick in until maybe January 15th, if not later.
So will anyone, as the law stands now with what's going away now, will any North Dakotans qualify for any healthcare tax credits?
Yeah, and it goes back to what I started out by talking about, where you have those advanced premium tax credits. They are not set to expire, but that also only affects a certain demographic. And I, as it relates to these EPTCs, that is what's set to expire. And so for individuals that are eligible for that, you're looking at 100% federal poverty level. You're looking at, for an individual over $15,000 and above, where you would get some type of assistance with those tax credits. I think there's just a lot happening in the world and in our country. And when you look at the economy, and this has been reflective in a recent Survivor View survey that we conducted. We do a series of surveys where we bring together a panel of cancer survivors, cancer patients that have had a diagnosis or treatments in the last 7 years. And of that, we're looking at just 41% were aware of the tax credits that are set to expire. But of those individuals, 96% of those receiving healthcare tax credits say they would have incredible difficulty getting the care they need without those tax credits. 63% say it would be extremely difficult. 72% of those receiving them say they would not have afforded a healthcare plan without the tax credits. And we're looking at a quarter, so 25% of this group that we surveyed would be likely become uninsured or underinsured if these tax credits are not extended. And so we're seeing that in our surveys and other groups that are reaching out. And I think especially for this group of individuals, you know, they're hoping to survive. They're raising families. They're looking at a way where they can afford their treatment. And I think our organization certainly has been doing a lot of work across the country to capture stories of individuals and to see what the impact would be for them and the uncertainty that exists. For individuals that are in this category, it's their life circumstances are very fluid. And especially for a cancer patient, or say you have a member of your family that has a cancer diagnosis and their employment situation is very fluid. And I think that's one of the things that we're going to be looking at for the long term as it relates to regardless of what happens with these tax credits is the interplay that these tax credits in the marketplace has with Medicaid and Medicaid expansion. And we know the changes that are set to start rolling out in the coming years, which is definitely going to impact individuals' access and ability to have ongoing, consistent, comprehensive health insurance. And so, you know, one of the concerns we have as an organization is that ripple effect for individuals that are dealing with those affordability issues, that continuity of care is so important for cancer patients, where they're not going to have a gap in coverage. And inevitably, if you have individuals that are seeing it where they can't, you know, they're healthy, younger, they don't see it as they don't need health insurance, them dropping out of the risk pool, it's going to, again, it's going to increase costs for all of us, regardless of the type of health insurance we have. So that's the one thing that, you know, we're very mindful of is health insurance is incredibly complicated. And this issue, going back to your previous question about why people aren't more aware, they may not even realize they're eligible for these tax credits. They're receiving these tax credits that are set to expire.
They signed up last year. They found a rate that worked for them. Inherent in that rate were these tax credits. And now all of a sudden, they're not going to be there. Is that what you're saying?
That's absolutely correct. And there's one individual that reached out with her story. She unfortunately was diagnosed with cancer. She then lost her job and she's left in limbo. And fortunately, she was able to qualify for Medicaid expansion. Her circumstances changed with her income level. She was then able to get onto a marketplace plan and to benefit from these tax credits. And fortunately, she's got a job lined up with health insurance benefits starting in January. But just look at that period of time in the last 6 months for this individual, where fortunately in North Dakota, she had affordable options to ensure that she had that continuity coverage, that she's not sacrificing or compromising her cancer care and increasing her survivorship and also hopefully avoiding medical debt by having that health insurance coverage.
Enjoying my conversation with David Benson. He's the Senior Campaigns Manager for the American Cancer Society, the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. He's helping us understand how tax credits shape healthcare access across the state and what the future may hold for affordability in North Dakota. And David, I want to reach back to a comment you made earlier about how for those of us who have healthcare coverage via a job, perhaps this impacts us. The fact that these tax credits are going away, this will make our care more expensive. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, and we're already seeing that in terms of, you know, with the premium increase that health plans are already submitting, where they're anticipating that if these tax credits are not going to be continued, extended. And so regardless of whether you are benefiting from these tax credits, it's going to have that impact on risk pool individuals that are just going to be finding that the health insurance options are not going to be in reach, are going to be not affordable. And with other costs that are increasing, this might be a place where, hey, I'm healthy and I'm young. I don't feel like I need to have a health insurance plan. And that's been the benefit of these tax credits and with ACA is the decrease in uninsured rates. And
rather than the only the sickest then would have coverage.
Correct.
Which is expensive. Yeah.
And so what you have again is that ripple effect where if individuals are being risky and are then faced with something never imagined, like a cancer diagnosis, they're then showing up at the emergency room. And it's instead of accessing screenings, cancer detection to catch cancer early, catch on the front end. It's going to, you know, by not doing that, it can impact their survival rates, where we know that if we're able to catch cancer early, a much better chance for that diagnosis and treatment and for survival rates. And so it's, you know, that is one of many concerns. You know, we talk a lot about affordability, but for some individuals, this can be life and death, where if they don't have health insurance and they're popping into the hospital, the emergency room at a much later state of their health, and having a stage four diagnosis can be very life-threatening.
Yeah, but I want to talk about what North Dakotans often get wrong about tax credits, if I could. Common misconceptions, such as believing credits must be paid back in full, or they only apply to very low-income households. Is that a myth?
Well, no. I mean, there is certainly a window of eligibility for individuals. If you're making under 100%, you are not eligible for 100% of FPL. So you're looking at
federal poverty level, by the way.
Thank you. Yes. Under, you know, $16,000, you're not eligible for subsidies. And you're in North Dakota, you're likely to be on Medicaid expansion. And in paying back, that is, again, the uncertainty that comes when someone goes on the marketplace, when you are applying. You are estimating what you think your income level is going to be. And that could fluctuate, that could be different at the end. And so for some people, if they are estimating they're going to be making more and they're not, you might be getting something back with your taxes at the end, or you might be paying in to cover the difference. And so that's one of the challenges for consumers is that can be an estimate on the front end in terms of what you might be getting for a tax credit.
Seems to me there may be confusion between tax credits and Medicaid eligibility. Explain to us the difference there, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the eligibility for the tax credits, you know, you're looking at your age, you're looking at your income level, family size. In some states, it depends, you know, being a tobacco user could be a factor in terms of tax credit. So for the Medicaid expansion eligibility, that is up to 138% of FPL. And so there's going to be a little bit of overlap. And that's where you see a little bit of that churn of individuals that might be on Medicaid expansion, their circumstances change, and they might be on a marketplace plan and back and forth. And as we know, with low income or gig workers, or for those in the ag sector, there can be a lot of uncertainty, not only for you or for others in your household.
What should we be doing today relative to open enrollment or even special enrollment?
Well, I think for individuals that might be in a situation where they are looking for health insurance options, they're not getting it through their employer, they're not eligible for Medicaid, is walk through the process on healthcare.gov. There you'll be able to understand what the cost will be for you and your family, and would at a certain point in time have a better sense of what those cost sharing elements will be. And so it's a very unpredictable time right now, and hopefully we'll have some certainty in the coming days or weeks. But healthcare.gov is an incredible resource. There's some other resources online that the state provides and help navigating individuals through that process.
What are you watching for in Washington right now, David?
Well, this is the big concern is the extension of these tax credits and ensuring that individuals are aware of it as quickly as possible. As you talked about, people are not aware of the extension, and we want to ensure that people are always looking for health insurance options. And so if these are not extended, then we're going to be looking at that ripple effect for the uncompensated care and the impact it's going to have on hospitals and the impact it's going to have on the state and counties when you're dealing with an increase in uninsured individuals. So right now, all our focus is on Congress. We feel like there is an incredible opportunity that our congressional delegation should be looking at. Knowing that the thousands of North Dakotans are going to be put in a very, very difficult position in terms of their continuity of coverage and to afford health insurance at all.
One thing I'm wondering about, David, as we kind of wrap up our conversation, I actually have two questions here, but is it your perception that tax credits as they exist today are enough to meet North Dakota's rural health challenges?
Well, it's incredibly important that right now these tax credits are extended. That's an incredible, important first step that Congress needs to look at. We need to ensure that we continue to invest and empower Medicaid expansion that has had a huge impact on the state and has provided comprehensive, reliable healthcare coverage for thousands of North Dakotans. And so as we look at not only the impact of these tax credits potentially not being extended, the implementation of elements of the Big Beautiful Bill that is set to be implemented in the coming years, there's a variety of factors that are putting stress and concerns on our rural providers, our rural health systems. And as we know, when you have a rural hospital that is closed, the impact it has on that community. And so North Dakota is certainly not alone in this. There's a health transformation fund that is going to be investing in various aspects all across the country and in North Dakota to provide different resources and opportunities for our healthcare sector in rural areas. But we are not finished in this work. And so our organization continues to be the voice of those concerns for our rural patients and survivors that are looking for, treatments that they're not having to go into travel state borders or travel hundreds and hundreds of miles. And this is not only a concern, this is a concern for tribal members that are accessing IHS. And so it's the healthcare system as a whole that I think we just need to be mindful of, but these tax credits are a huge part of that.
Finally, David, are you hearing directly from our delegation? And if so, what are they telling you?
Yeah, we're fortunate that we had meetings with the congressional delegation back when we had our annual lobby day and leadership summit back in September. We were very pleased that they're taking a very close look and really trying to get a handle of this issue and the impact it's having on North Dakotans. Our organization is lifting up stories of individuals that are being impacted. And Craig, I can't tell you the hundreds of stories that I've been exposed to of individuals that are incredibly concerned, where they feel they are going to be left out of any type of viable, affordable option. And not only the impact that's going to have on their family, but for those individuals possibly having to file bankruptcy, having incredible medical debt because in order to afford their cancer treatment. And so it's heartbreaking. And so we certainly have been doing our due diligence to share those stories and those concerns by individuals across the country. Congress still has a chance to make this right and find a pathway to extend the tax credits before it's too late. And many of their constituents' lives depend on it.
That's David Benson. He's the Senior Campaigns Manager for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. He's helped us understand how tax credits are shaped and how it determines ultimately healthcare access across the state and what the future may hold for affordability here in North Dakota. David, thank you for joining us today on Main Street.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation in partnership with Strengthen ND, announcing the 2025 Bush Prize North Dakota honorees, TNT Kids Fitness, and Hip Hop and Hope. More at strengthenND.com.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
It's Layla Faldin. Look, I won't say that listening to Morning Edition makes you cool. I mean, I think that. But you might learn something that does.
One of the latest fitness fads involves wearing a weighted vest as you walk around.
Ed Sheeran has a new album that's bursting with international flavor.
The American Association of Orthodontists declared that braces have never been cooler.
Stay in the know with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. Central on Prairie Public. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/DakotaPlans.
And that wraps up this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, Rick Gian introduces us to Matt Wallowak. He's opened the new Harry's Steakhouse in West Fargo, and that's in addition to Harry's in Grand Forks. He has a long history in the restaurant industry, and Rick will bring us his story. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.